Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1025, the so-called Arab Spring, unquote, revisited. This is being recorded on September 25th of the year 2018. About, well, not quite 8 years ago, but well over 7 years ago in early 2011, I did a series of shows, For the Record 733 through For the Record 739, in which I discussed the Arab Spring and voiced my opinion that not only was it not a spontaneous occurrence, but that actually it was an op, specifically a reactionary Western intelligence operation intended to supplant some of the medieval petrol monarchies and some of the dictatorships or authoritarian, unquote, governments in the Middle East with Muslim Brotherhood governments. The point being here, from the standpoint, I believe, of the powers that be in this country, was to stave off any possibility of progressive political movements coming to power eventually in some of those reactionary petrol monarchies or in some of the dictatorships that existed in the Middle East. It was also a goal, I believe, to install the Muslim Brotherhood in power in as many of the Middle Eastern countries as was possible. In many shows, we have talked about the Muslim Brotherhood. To make a very long story short, the Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization begun in 1928. It was allied with the Axis in World War II, and then, like so many fascist organizations, jumped to Western intelligence, the CIA and its precursor, the OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination under Frank Wisner, before that. The goal was for the Brotherhood to be used as an anti-communist force in the Muslim world, and also eventually to be used as a proxy warrior against the former Soviet Union and now Russia. It was used in the Balkans, and also via the Uyghurs, it is being used in China as well, specifically Xinjiang province, which is home to the Uyghurs, a Turkophone Muslim people with affiliations both with Al-Qaeda and with the secular fascist terrorist Grey Wolves, the goal being to split off mineral and petroleum-rich Xinjiang province from China. The Afghan Mujahideen, which directly spawned Al-Qaeda, is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, or really a subsidiary of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas, along with Palestinian Islamic Jihad, are Palestinian branches of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were at one point united, but then there was a schism over some ideological consideration. And as I said, the Muslim Brotherhood has been seen as an anti-communist force, and beyond that, as a proxy warrior entity in the Arab and Muslim world, and also as a proxy warrior entity in the Balkans, in the Caucasus, in Russia, and the former Soviet Union, and also in Xinjiang province in China as well. Today, as I speak, on September 25th of 2018, contributing editor Tara Frackle has unearthed an important series of articles about the recent terror attack on a military parade in Iran. Iran is blaming the attack on U.S.-backed Middle Eastern states. And with John Bolton being an unbridled and explicit hawk on the subject of Iran, and Rudy Giuliani, Trump's attorney, also being an unabashed supporter of the MEK, formerly at one time classified as a terrorist organization. That is the anti-Mullah Iranian expatriate organization. We are seeing a heightening of tensions between the Shiite fundamentalist regime in Iran originally, as we looked at in For the Record 896 through 899, installed by the U.S. In order to place an anti-communist entity on the southern flank of the former Soviet Union. The Shia fundamentalists in Iran and also Shiite Muslim countries in the Middle East are being backed by Russia. By the same token, Sunni Muslim fundamentalists, including and especially Al-Qaeda and its affiliate and subsidiary organizations, are being backed by the West as proxy warriors against Russia and against some of the Russian proxy warrior Shiite regimes or proxy entities. This is not to say that Russia is really big on Shia Islam, but its southern flank is being threatened by Al-Qaeda and has been for quite some time. The Al-Taqwa organization, which had an unlimited line of credit for Al-Qaeda and which figured prominently in the September 11th attacks, a participation that was obfuscated, and that's a polite word, by Robert Mueller when he was head of the FBI, when he sidetracked Operation Green Quest, along with other members of the George W. Bush administration, for all we know, including Brett Kavanaugh. I think that the furor over Kavanaugh's apparently outrageous, although not all that unusual, adolescent drunken sexual behavior has served to eclipse things that are more important. With the complicity of the George W. Bush administration in the September 11th attacks, not the controlled demolition nonsense put out by David Ray Griffin and the other charlatans who occupy the 9/11 controlled demolition clown car, but the fact that the Bush and Bin Laden families had been in business for decades, the fact that members of the Bin Laden family were flown out of the U.S. in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks before they could be interviewed by the FBI, including some members of the family who had and still maintain some terror connections. And then when the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002 took place, revealing strong links between the GOP and the Islamic Free Market Institute of Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and other members of the Bush administration and Republican Party, that was swept under the rug. And one of the janitors who did so was very possibly Brett Kavanaugh. We don't know for sure just what his behavior was vis-a-vis the many salient questions about September 11th, but those have been eclipsed by his sexual misadventures, and that is most unfortunate. I don't hold a brief for rape, drunken or juvenile or otherwise. However, being an accessory to premeditated mass murder certainly is more important. And for we don't know what Brett Kavanaugh may have done when he was the secretary of George W. Bush's staff. In any event, the proxy warfare that has been occurring to an extent between Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood and countries like Russia and, to an extent, China, continues in Syria. As we spoke about in For the Record 1024, the last jihadi, quote, rebel, unquote, entity or enclave in Syria is Idlib, that's I-D-L-I-B as in boy province, and the group that dominates that province is basically the latest iteration of al-Qaeda in Syria. More about that in just a minute. We're going to be talking about the Muslim Brotherhood Spring, as I call the Arab Spring, the fact that it was an op, and what lies behind it. However, I think that due to not only misinformation, but a genuine lack of understanding of just what is going on here, I'm going to review some information, not only about the Muslim Brotherhood and its economic theories, but also about how that plays into favor with elements in the West. And we are going to see how the Western and U.S. favoritism toward the Muslim Brotherhood is simply the latest iteration of what Mussolini, who invented the term fascism, called corporatism. Il Duce said, quote, "Il fascismo e il corporatismo." Fascism is corporatism. He called his system the corporate state. And for obvious reasons, that, quote, neoliberal, unquote, philosophy resonated very nicely with powerful economic interests in the West, who had backed fascism as a perceived antidote to labor unrest, communism, and the former Soviet Union as well. We're going to review some information from a Newsweek article, and I realize that, actually, before I do this, I'm going to pontificate a little bit more here. One of the things that I think has served to obfuscate the corporatist nature of the Muslim Brotherhood and the sympathy that that has won it in the West is basically Orientalism on the right wing and with Team Trump, so to speak. We are seeing a negative Orientalism where basically Arabs, Muslims, including the Muslim Brotherhood, are perceived as Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, cackling, bearded cutthroats, riding into their cave hideout on black chargers and then dismounting and unburdening their saddlebags and running their fingers through streams of gold coins while they cackle maniacally. And this all, of course, with scimitars in their teeth. On the left, on the other hand, in the so-called progressive sector, we have a different kind of Orientalism where Arabs and Muslims are seen as beatific little creatures, perhaps conceptualized as Aladdin, who sails in the front door on the magic carpet, rubs his magic lantern, and out comes Scheherazade doing a belly dance, while Amy Goodman provides a percussion accompaniment on finger cymbals, and the assembly sings Kumbaya in Arabic. And between those two positive and negative manifestations of Orientalism, the negative on the part of the right with the bandits with scimitars in their teeth riding their black chargers into the cave and running gold coins through their fingers, and then Aladdin with a beatific smile on his face and Scheherazade doing a belly dance. The realities of the Muslim Brotherhood, its economic theories, and also its utility as a proxy warrior through its al-Qaeda offshoots and related offshoots has been obfuscated.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We're going to review briefly segments of an article from Newsweek magazine from the issue of July 3rd through 10th of 2006. This is an article called Islam in Office by Stephen, S-T-E-P-A-G-N, Glain, capital G-L-A-I-N. In this, Glain writes, skipping down, "The Prophet Muhammad, himself a trader, preached merchant honor, the only regulation that the borderless Levantine market knew," skipping down again. "In Muslim liturgy, The veals cut in the soup become a metaphor for the contract between God and the faithful, and the business model Muhammad prescribed, according to Muslim scholars and economists, is very much in the laissez-faire tradition later embraced in the West. One more time. And the business model Muhammad prescribed, according to Muslim scholars and economists, is very much in the laissez-faire tradition later embraced by the West. Prices were to be set by God alone, anticipating by more than a millennium Adam Smith's reference to the, quote, invisible hand, unquote, of market-based pricing. Skipping down. The Muslim Brotherhood hails 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun, that's capital IBN, last name capital K-H-A-L-D-U-N, as its economic guide. Anticipating supply-side economics, Khaldun argued that cutting taxes raises production and tax revenues, and that state control should be limited to providing water, fire, and free grazing land, the utilities of the ancient world. Note the next sentence. The World Bank has called Ibn Khaldun the first advocate of privatization. His founding influence is a sign of moderation. I would take that with a grain of salt. We're going to talk about the Brotherhood in action in a minute. And if what they do is moderation, well, I'd hate to see extremism. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. No, indeed. And perhaps talking about Ibn Khaldun as being seen by the World Bank as the first advocate of privatization. By the way, this laissez-faire Islamic corporatism is precisely the reason that Grover Norquist and Karl Rove founded the Islamic Free Market Institute. Its managing director was Talat Altman, a member of the board of directors of George W. Bush's first oil company, and a fellow who was a personal friend and political ally of both George's Bush, and who gave a Muslim benediction at the 2001 Republican George W. Bush's Republican inauguration. I would note that it was that very same Talat Altman who interceded on behalf of the institutions and individuals targeted by the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids. And then in December of that year, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, with whom he interceded, was fired. And again, Robert Mueller, that very special prosecutor, was head of the FBI and swept us under the rug. Do note what it says here. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. Placing that Ibn Khaldun dynamic in perhaps more recognizable context, let's go to the New York Times of October 2nd of 1981. This is an article by Robert D. McFadden, capital M-C, capital F-A-D-D-E-N. Reagan cites Islamic scholar. President Reagan, in his news conference yesterday, again, this is October of 81, cited a 14th century Islamic scholar as an early exponent of the, quote, supply-side, unquote, economic theory on which his administration bases many of its policies. An authority on the scholar later said that the reference seemed accurate. Skipping down. Responding to a question about the effects of tax and spending cuts that began taking effect yesterday, Mr. Reagan said the supply-side principle dated at least as far back as Ibn Khaldun, who is generally regarded as the greatest Arab historian to emerge from the highly developed Arabic culture of the Middle Ages. I think it is unintentionally revealing that Ronald Reagan cited a Middle Ages theoretician as justification for his policies. And as to how well that worked out, well, Ronald Reagan presided in 8 years over some put it as low as threefold increase in the national debt. Others, a 3.5-fold increase in the national debt. In other words, he incurred 3 to 3.5 times as much national debt as all of the previous presidents in American history, from George Washington through Jimmy Carter, put together. Young people who maybe have only heard about what a great guy Reagan was and how he did this right and that right. Again, Ronald Reagan incurred between a maximum of 3.5 times as much national debt as all of the previous presidents from George Washington through Jimmy Carter put together. That's not too good. More about Ibn Khaldun. This from another Stephen Glane article, this, however, from the Washington Post, of January 24th of 2012. Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood adopting caution on economic matters. And it talks about how it was basically a laissez-faire agenda on the part of the Brotherhood. Skipping down, Brotherhood members trace their capitalist conceit to the birth of Islam and tend to associate one with the other. Islam endorses the market and free trade. Abdel Hamzid Abu Zaid, a Muslim Brotherhood member and economist at Cairo University, said in an interview before his death last year. It is part and parcel of Islam as a complete way of life. Not for nothing, Brotherhood members are fond of saying, reminding Westerners, did Ronald Reagan suggest that the philosophies of Ibn Khaldun, a 14th century Islamic scholar, anticipated the Laffer curve by 600 years? Indeed, I think that speaks for itself. We're going to talk about the Arab Spring or the Muslim Brotherhood Spring. Bear in mind that the laissez-faire, free market, corporatist, privatization aspect of Brotherhood economic philosophy are front and center, and that powerful industrial and financial interests in the West backed it for the same reason that they backed Mussolini and Hitler and the Japanese in World War II. They liked fascist economics. They liked corporatismo, as Mussolini put it. One of the manifestations of Muslim Brotherhood combatants as proxy warriors were the Afghan Mujahideen, who helped to bring down the former Soviet Union and who also spawned Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. They were presided over by Graham Fuller, a very, very important, quote, former, unquote, CIA officer. I don't think any serious history of the 20th and 21st centuries would be complete without discussion of Graham Fuller, a very important man, and someone who, again, presided over the Afghan Mujahideen. He also wrote the paper that is believed to have launched the Iran-Contra scandal as well. In NSFWCorp.com of June 5th of 2013, Mark Ames wrote an article called Chechenian Power, and it is excerpted as follows. Fuller comes from that faction of CIA Cold Warriors who believed and apparently still believe that fundamentalist Islam, even in its radical jihadi form, does not pose a threat to the West for the simple reason that fundamentalist Islam is conservative, against social justice, against socialism and redistribution of wealth, and in favor of hierarchical socioeconomic structures. Socialism is the common enemy to both capitalist America and to Wahhabi Islam, according to Graham Fuller. Quote, there is no mainstream Islamic organization with radical social views, Fuller wrote. Classical Islamic theory envisages the role of the state as limited to facilitating the well-being of markets and merchants rather than controlling them. Islamists have always powerfully objected to socialism and communism. Islam has never had problems with the idea that wealth is unevenly distributed. That hopefully will give people a working mini seminar on Muslim Brotherhood economic theory and why the Muslim Brotherhood has been seen as a desirable organization to maintain power or achieve power in the Arab and Islamic world. What we're going to do now is to take a look at how Al-Qaeda came to be a dominant player in Syria. As I am speaking on September 25th of 2018, there has been a pause in the foreseen and widely predicted offensive by Bashar Assad's government and some of their Russian military supporters. For the time being, there is a demilitarized zone that has been negotiated ostensibly between Syria and Turkey, and with the Russians going along. It remains to be seen if that forestalls further combat. Recall in our last program, we discussed how the stage had been set for a chemical attack provocation by the Al-Qaeda jihadists in Idlib province that would invite unnamed retaliatory measures by the U.S., France, Britain, and perhaps also Germany as well. That, for the time being, that offensive is on hold. However, what we're going to do is to take a look at how the Arab Spring led to the resurrection of Al-Qaeda and the positioning of the latest iteration of Al-Qaeda in Idlib province, where Al-Qaeda is serving as a proxy warrior against not only the Shia government, although actually the primarily Shia nation of Syria, the Assad regime itself has been Alawite traditionally. The article that we're going to use here is one we excerpted in our last program. It is mainstream, albeit good, analysis coming from the Council on Foreign Relations of March 6th of 2018 by Bruce Hoffman, H-O-F-F-N-A-N, I believe a former RAND Corporation analyst. So this is not left-wing, quote, radical, unquote, analysis. It's called Al-Qaeda's Resurrection, and it talks about the role specifically of the Arab Spring in the resurrection and expansion of Al-Qaeda into Syria. We should bear in mind that with jihadist elements continuing to wage warfare when they can in the Caucasus, the Tsarnaev brothers being an apparent under the Boston Marathon bombers being an apparent offshoot of that, we could think of the Al-Qaeda / Muslim Brotherhood proxy warriors as basically fulfilling the role of von Paulus's 6th Army in World War II, when General von Paulus, led his 6th Army in an attempt to capture Stalingrad and to seize the Caucasian oil fields from the former Soviet Union, thereby enhancing Germany's war-making production and crippling the ability of the former Soviet Union to fight industrial war. Of course, that ended with the Battle of Stalingrad and the destruction of von Paulus's army. We can think of Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood as manifesting in the Caucasus as sort of 6th Army 2.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
From the CFR of March 6th of 2018, Al-Qaeda's Resurrection by Bruce Hoffman. While the soap, by the way, before I read this, there are a number of important points to take note of. First of all, note the role of the Arab Spring. It was fundamental to the resurrection of Al-Qaeda. More about that later. Note also that initially, the Islamic State and the Al-Qaeda subsidiary in Syria were one and the same. Eventually, they had a schism, they had a split. But note that ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria were at one point the same. That having been said, from the Bruce Hoffman Al-Qaeda's resurrection, while the self-proclaimed Islamic State has dominated the headlines and preoccupied national security officials for the past 4 years, Al-Qaeda has been quietly rebuilding. Its announcement last summer of another affiliate, this one dedicated to the liberation of Kashmir, coupled with the resurrection of its presence in Afghanistan and the solidification of its influence in Syria, Yemen, and Somalia, underscores the resiliency and continued vitality of the U.S.'s preeminent terrorist enemy. Although Al-Qaeda's rebuilding and reorganization predates the 2011 Arab Spring, the upheaval that followed helped the movement revive itself. At the time, an unbridled optimism among local and regional rights activists and Western governments held that a combination of popular protest, civil disobedience, and social media had rendered terrorism an irrelevant anachronism. The longing for democracy and economic reform, it was argued, had decisively trumped repression and violence. However, where the optimists saw irreversible positive change, Al-Qaeda discerned new and inviting opportunities. By the way, I should also add that just as in World War II, the fascist nations were seen as useful vehicles for destroying the former Soviet Union and suppressing communist movements and labor unions in all of the areas that they conquered, so too there was a very real war fought between Western armies, the U.S., Britain, and others, against those fascist combatants. But many of the most powerful industrialists and financiers in the West were basically pro-fascist, and although they were certainly more than happy to land the lucrative war manufacturing contracts from the munitions business that stoked World War II, they were basically pro-fascist because of the corporatist economics and because they saw Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy and Imperial Japan as proxy warriors against the Soviet Union and socialist movements and labor unions. So too today, just as there is a very real combat between Al-Qaeda offshoots and organizations like the Taliban around the world, with U.S. and other countries' service personnel having lost, suffered casualties in that combat. At the same time, because of the corporatist economics and because of the utility of the Al-Qaeda offshoots, the Muslim Brotherhood offshoots like Al-Qaeda as proxy warriors, the corporate elite and the financial elite and their associated political elites are basically working both sides of the street. And skipping down. In this Bruce Hoffman article, in retrospect, however, it appears that Al-Qaeda was among the regional forces that benefited most from the Arab Springs tumult. 7 years later, Ayman al-Zawahiri has emerged as a powerful leader with a strategic vision that he has systematically implemented. Forces loyal to Al-Qaeda and its affiliates now number in the tens of thousands, with a capacity to disrupt local and regional stability, as well as launch attacks against their declared enemies in the Middle East, Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, Europe, and Russia. Indeed, from northwestern Africa to South Asia, Al-Qaeda has knit together a global movement of more than 24 franchises. In Syria alone, Al-Qaeda now has upwards of 20,000 men under arms, and it has perhaps another 4,000 in Yemen and about 7,000 in Somalia. Next section, the Arab Spring's big winner. The thousands of hardened Al-Qaeda fighters freed from Egypt from Egyptian prisons in 2012-2013 by Muslim Brotherhood Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi galvanized the movement at a critical moment when instability reigned and a handful of men well-versed in terrorism and subversion could plunge a country or a region into chaos. Whether in Libya, Turkey, Syria, or Yemen, their arrival was providential in terms of advancing Al-Qaeda's interests or increasing its influence. The military coup that subsequently toppled Morsi validated Zawahiri's repeated warnings not to believe Western promises about either the fruits of democracy or the sanctity of free and fair elections. It was Syria where Al-Qaeda's intervention proved most consequential. One of Zawahiri's first official acts after succeeding bin Laden as emir was to order a Syrian veteran of the Iraqi insurgency named Abu Muhammad al-Julami to return home and establish the Al-Qaeda franchise that would eventually become Jabhat al-Nusra. Al-Qaeda's blatantly sectarian messaging over social media further sharpened the historical frictions between Sunnis and Shias and gave the movement entree into internal Syrian politics that it needed to solidify its presence in that country. Al-Qaeda's chosen instrument was Jabhat al-Nusra, the product of a joint initiative with Al-Qaeda's Iraqi branch, which had rebranded itself as the Islamic State of Iraq, or ISI. This last sentence again. Not many people realize that the Islamic State was originally part of Al-Qaeda. They split in a schism, but one more time. Al-Qaeda's chosen instrument in Syria was Jabhat, J-A-B-H-A-T, Al-A-L hyphen Nusra, capital N-U-S-R-A, the product of a joint initiative with Al-Qaeda's Iraqi branch, which had rebranded itself as the Islamic State of Iraq, or ISI. But as Nusra grew in both strength and impact, a dispute erupted between ISI and Al-Qaeda over control of the group. In a bold power grab, ISI's leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi announced the forcible amalgamation of al-Nusra with ISI in a new organization to be called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. Julami, on the other hand, refused to accede to the unilateral merger and appealed to Zawahiri. The quarrel intensified, and after Zawahiri's attempts to mediate it collapsed, he expelled ISIS from the Al-Qaeda network. Although ISIS, which has since rebranded itself the Islamic State, has commanded the world's attention since then, Al-Qaeda has been quietly rebuilding and fortifying its various branches. Al-Qaeda has systematically implemented an ambitious strategy designed to protect its senior leadership and discreetly consolidate its influence wherever the movement has a significant presence. Accordingly, its leaders have been dispersed to Syria, Iran, Turkey, Libya, and Yemen, with only a hardcore remnant of top commanders still in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Advances in commercial digital communication tools, alongside successive public revelations of U.S. and allied intelligence services' eavesdropping capabilities, have enabled Al-Qaeda's leaders and commanders to maintain contact via secure end-to-end encryption technology. I would, by the way, take that one with a grain of salt, that last sentence. We'll talk about more about that, perhaps, in future discussion of a book that I hope to excerpt, however briefly, in this program, namely Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. Continuing. The number of top Al-Qaeda leaders sent to Syria over the past half dozen years underscores the high priority that the movement attaches to that country. Among them was Muhsin al-Fadi, a bin Laden intimate who, until his death in a 2015 U.S. airstrike, commanded the movement's elite forward-based operational arm in that country known as the Khorasan Group. He also functioned as Zawahiri's local emissary, charged with attempting to heal the rift between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Haydar Kerkan, a Turkish national and long-standing senior operative, was sent by bin Laden himself to Turkey in 2010 to lay the groundwork for the movement's expansion into the Levant before the Arab Spring created precisely that opportunity. Kerkan was also responsible for facilitating the movement of other senior Al-Qaeda personnel from Pakistan to Syria to escape the escalating drone strike campaign ordered by President Barack Obama. He was killed in 2016 in a U.S. bombing raid. The previous fall marked the arrival of Saif al-Adl, who was arguably the movement's most battle-hardened commander. Adl ADL is a former Egyptian army commando whose terrorist pedigree dating to the late 1970s includes assassination plots against Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat, the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and al-Qaeda's post-9/11 terrorist campaigns in Saudi Arabia and South Asia. He also served as mentor to bin Laden's presumptive heir, his son Hamza bin Laden, after both Adl and the boy sought sanctuary in Iran following the commencement of U.S. and coalition military operations in Afghanistan in late 2001. The younger bin Laden's own reported appearance in Syria this past summer provides fresh evidence of the movement's fixation with a country that has become the most popular venue to wage holy war since the seminal Afghan jihad of the 1980s, by the way, supported by the U.S. and presided over by Graham Fuller. Indeed, al-Qaeda's presence in Syria is far more pernicious than that of ISIS. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, the latest name adopted by al-Qaeda's local affiliate, is now the largest rebel group in the country, having extended its control last year over all of Idlib province along the Syrian-Turkish border. This is the culmination of a process al-Qaeda began more than 3 years ago to annihilate the Free Syrian Army and any other group that challenges al-Qaeda's regional aspirations. For the sake of argument, combat eventually does resume in Idlib province, and if there is a chemical weapons provocation with the promised support of Western forces, in effect, the U.S. will be preventing, and the West will be providing air cover for al-Qaeda. I would note that both the bloodbath in Syria, the Syrian civil war, and the bloodbath in Libya were outgrowths of the Muslim Spring, and both were accompanied by heavy NATO air campaigns, with basically the West providing air cover for al-Qaeda. The last section of the Bruce Hoffman article that I'm going to read concerns al-Qaeda using local dynamics to help fold local forces into the international movement. Al-Qaeda's success in resurrecting its global network is the result of three strategic moves made by Zawahiri. The first was to strengthen the decentralized franchise approach that has facilitated the movement's survival. Over the years, the leaders and deputies of al-Qaeda's far-flung franchises have been integrated into the movement's deliberative and consultative processes. Today, al-Qaeda is truly, quote, global, G-L-O-C-A-L, unquote, having effectively incorporated local grievances and concerns into a global narrative that forms the foundation of an all-encompassing grand strategy. The second major move was the order issued by Zawahiri in 2013 to avoid mass casualty operations, especially those that might kill Muslim civilians. Al-Qaeda has thus been able to present itself through social media paradoxically as moderate extremists, unquote, ostensibly more palatable than ISIS. I would note that in passing in this regard, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which has won the reputation of being sort of a Muslim version of any one of a number of civil rights organizations, was actually revealed in the Holy Land trials to be a Muslim Brotherhood front organization, and they have backed Black Lives Matter, thereby to an extent implementing the, quote, global, unquote, strategy of al-Zawahiri.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
We're going to repeat as much as I have time to read here of an article that I read in For the Record 787. And this really describes not only how Al-Qaeda was resurrected in the Middle East as a result of the Muslim Spring, but as a result of the Arab Spring, unquote, I call the Muslim Brotherhood Spring. But it also illustrates the networking and the close coordination between the Muslim Brotherhood, which ostensibly favors a more gradual, moderate program, and the Al-Qaeda organization. They actually are two different sides of the same coin. This is from the Islam Translated blog by Raymond, R-A-Y-M-O-N-D, Ibrahim, capital I-B-R-A-H-I-M, of February 4th of 2014. It's titled, Exposed, the Muslim Brotherhood Al-Qaeda Connection by Raymond Ibrahim. Skipping down. Concerning some of the more severe allegations, one of Egypt's most widely distributed and read newspapers, Al-Watan, capital A-L, capital W-A-T-A-N, recently published what it said were recorded conversations between Morsi and Mohammed Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri's brother. In these reports, Watan repeatedly asserts that Egyptian security and intelligence agencies confirmed or perhaps leaked out the recordings. Much of the substance of the alleged conversations is further corroborated by events that occurred during Morsi's one-year rule, most of which were reported by a variety of Arabic media outlets, though not by Western media. In what follows, I relay, summarize, and translate some of the more significant portions of the Watan reports. Verbatim statements are in quotation marks. In between, I comment on various anecdotes and events, many of which were first broken on my website, but now, in light of these phone conversations, make perfect sense and independently help confirm the authenticity of the recordings. The first recorded call between Mohammed Morsi and Mohammed al-Zawahiri, Ayman al-Zawahiri's brother, lasted for 59 seconds. Morsi congratulated Zawahiri on his release from prison, where he had been incarcerated for jihadi terrorist activities inside Egypt, and assured him that he would not be followed or observed by any Egyptian authorities, and that he, Morsi, was planning on meeting with him soon. Prior to this first call, Rafar al-Tatawi, T-H-T-A-W-Y, the chief of staff, mediated and arranged matters between the two. Morsi's presidential palace continued to communicate regularly with Mohammed Zawahiri, and sources confirmed that he was the link between the Egyptian presidency and his brother, Ayman Zawahiri, the Egyptian-born leader of Al-Qaeda. It should be noted that, once released, the previously little-known Mohammed Zawahiri did become very visible and very vocal in Egypt at times, spearheading the Islamist movement. The next recording between Morsi and Zawahiri lasted for 2 minutes and 56 seconds and took place 1 month after Morsi became president. Morsi informed Zawahiri that the Muslim Brotherhood supports the Mujahideen, or jihadis, and that the Mujahideen should support the Brotherhood in order for them both and the Islamist agenda to prevail in Egypt. This last sentence again. Last two sentences, really. The next recording between Morsi and Zawahiri lasted for 2 minutes and 56 seconds and took place 1 month after Morsi became president. Morsi informed Zawahiri that the Muslim Brotherhood supports the Mujahideen and that the Mujahideen should support the Brotherhood in order for them both and the Islamist agenda to prevail in Egypt. This makes sense in the context that, soon after Morsi came to power, the general public did become increasingly critical of him and his policies, including the fact that he was placing only Brotherhood members in Egypt's most important posts, trying quickly to push through a pro-Islamist constitution, and, as Egyptians called it, trying in general to brotherize, unquote, Egypt. The second phone call being longer than the first, Zawahiri took it as an opportunity to congratulate Morsi on his recent presidential victory, which incidentally from the start was portrayed by some as fraudulent, and expressed his joy that Morsi's presidency could only mean that, quote, all secular infidels would be removed from Egypt, unquote. Then Zawahiri told Morsi, quote, rule according to the Sharia of Allah or Islamic law, and we will stand next to you. Know that from the start, there is no so-called democracy, so get rid of your opposition, unquote. This assertion comports extremely well with his brother Ayman Zawahiri's views. A former Muslim Brotherhood member himself, some 30 years ago, the Al-Qaeda leader wrote Al-Hisad al-Mur, The Bitter Harvest, a scathing book condemning the Brotherhood for, quote, taking advantage of the Muslim youth's fervor by steering their one-time passionate Islamic zeal for jihad to conferences and elections, unquote. An entire section dedicated to showing that Islamic Sharia cannot coexist with democracy even appears in Ayman Zawahiri's book, The Al-Qaeda Reader. The call ended in agreement that Al-Qaeda would support the Brotherhood, including its international branches, under the understanding that Morsi would soon implement full Sharia in Egypt. After this, Mohammed Zawahiri and Khairat al-Shater, S-H-A-T-E-R, the number two man of the Muslim Brotherhood organization in Egypt, reportedly met regularly. It is interesting to note here that prior to these revelations, U.S. Ambassador to Egypt Anne Patterson was also seen visiting with Khairat al-Shater, even though he held no position in the Morsi government, and after the ousting and imprisonment of Morsi and leading Brotherhood members, Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham made it a point to visit the civilian Shater in his prison cell and urged the Egyptian government to release him. The next call, recorded roughly 6 weeks after the last one, again revolved around the theme of solidifying common cooperation between the Egyptian presidency and the Muslim Brotherhood on one hand, and Al-Qaeda and its jihadi offshoots on the other, specifically in the context of creating jihadi cells inside Egypt devoted to protecting the increasingly unpopular Brotherhood-dominated government. As I reported back in December of 2012, Egyptian media were saying that foreign jihadi fighters were appearing in large numbers. One said 3,000 fighters, especially in Sinai. And since the overthrow of the Brotherhood and the military crackdown on its supporters, many of those detained have been exposed speaking non-Egyptian dialects of Arabic. During the same call, Zawahiri was also critical of the Morsi government for still not applying Islamic Sharia throughout Egypt, which, as mentioned, was one of the prerequisites for Al-Qaeda's support. Morsi responded by saying, quote, we are currently in the stage of consolidating power and need the help of all parties, and we cannot at this time apply the Iranian model or Taliban rule in Egypt. It is impossible to do so now, unquote. In fact, while the Brotherhood has repeatedly declared its aspiration for world domination from its origins, it has always relied on a, quote, gradual, unquote, approach, moving only in stages, with the idea of culminating its full vision only when enough power has been consolidated. In response, Zawahiri told Morsi that as a show of goodwill, he must, quote, at least release the Mujahideen who were imprisoned during the Mubarak era, as well as all Islamists, as an assurance and pact of cooperation and proof that the old page has turned to a new one, unquote. After that call, and as confirmed by governmental sources, Morsi received a list from Zawahiri containing the names of the most dangerous terrorists in Egyptian jails, some of whom were on death row due to the enormity of their crimes. In fact, as I reported back in August of 2012, most imprisoned terrorists, including from Egypt's notorious Islamic Jihad organization, which was once led by Ayman Zawahiri, were released from captivity under Morsi. 1 year later, in August of 2013, soon after the removal of Morsi, Egypt's Interior Ministry announced that Egypt was, quote, preparing to cancel any presidential pardons issued during Morsi's era to terrorists or criminals, unquote. During the same call, and in the context of pardons, Morsi said he would do his best to facilitate the return of Mohammed's infamous brother and al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri back to Egypt with his head held high, unquote, in accordance with Islamist wishes, as well as urged the U.S. to release the blind sheikh and terrorist mastermind Omar Abdulrahman. In March of 2013, I wrote about how Morsi, during his Pakistan visit, had reportedly met with Ayman Zawahiri and made arrangements to smuggle him back to Sinai. According to a Pakistan source, the meeting was, quote, facilitated by elements of Pakistani intelligence, or ISI, and its influential members of the international organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, unquote. The gist of the next two calls between Morsi and Mohammed Zawahiri was that so long as the former is president, he would see to it that all released jihadis and al-Qaeda operatives were allowed to move freely throughout Egypt and the Sinai, and that the presidential palace would remain in contact with Zawahiri to make sure everything is moving to the satisfaction of both parties. Zawahiri further requested that Morsi allow them to develop training camps in Sinai in order to support the Brotherhood through trained militants, along with saying that the Brotherhood intended to form a, quote, revolutionary guard, unquote, to protect him against any coup. Morsi added that in return for al-Qaeda's and its affiliates' support, not only would he allow them to have such training camps, but he would facilitate their development in Sinai and give them four facilities to use along the Egyptian-Libyan border. That Libya is mentioned is interesting. According to a Libyan Arabic report I translated back in June of 2013, those who attacked the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, killing Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, were from jihadi cells that had been formed in Libya through Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood support. Those interrogated named Morsi and other top Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood leadership as accomplices. Bear in mind, it was Benghazi that led to the whole Hillary Clinton email, quote, scandal, unquote, and with James Comey and the FBI that had much to do with putting Donald Trump in office. Continuing. More evidence, including some that implicates the U.S. administration, has mounted since then. Next, Latam makes several more assertions, all of which are preceded by according to security and intelligence agencies. And we're going to continue this in our next program because there is too much material here for this broadcast, and I will repeat some key elements of the discussion here. It is a complex one, and again, with U.S. and other Western military personnel engaging in very real combat and sustaining very real casualties against Muslim Brotherhood offshoots, the sponsorship on the part of intelligence services and corporate elites of those very same organizations as, on the one hand, proxy warriors against Russia, against Iran and others, against Syria, and also as the bringers of corporatist economics, the doctrine of Ibn Khaldun, if you will. That may seem confusing, but it is altogether real. And again, note that according to the Egyptian intelligence and information I just presented, the attack on the U.S. embassy in Benghazi that led to the whole Benghazi hearings and the whole Hillary Clinton email brouhaha was conducted by Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood cadre who had been trained under the auspices of Morsi, under Mohammed Zawahiri, with the connivance of Morsi. This concludes For the Record program number 1025, the so-called Arab Spring Revisited. This is being recorded on September 25th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.